Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Will Marshall Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark, with your host, Rob Floyd, and co-host, Phyllis Floyd. Tonight's topic, the Toolbox Murders. Well, hey everybody, welcome back to the old podcast. Isn't that announcer guy something?
He is just fantastic.
He's got a great face for radio. Hey, Phyllis.
Hi, Rob.
Tonight, we're talking about the 78 classic, well, maybe not classic, but the Toolbox Murders. This is one of those films I had heard about for years and years and years, and just it never got around to seeing. And finally did get to see it a little while back and decided to revisit it here to talk about the podcast. This was your first time seeing it, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was my very first time. I'm oh so thrilled.
And that's our review. Good night, everybody. No, it was, you know, it's not a bad movie. It's not a great, it tries to walk the line between a slasher film, a gore film, and a thriller. And it kind of just misses the boat on being really good at either one, you know?
Yes.
The best thing about it, I have to say, is the way it's shot.
Yeah, the cinematography, well, for good reason.
Yeah, the cinematography in it is, you know, there's some really interesting shots that build a little suspense or really could build some suspense. And they do at the beginning a little more, I think, than towards the end. But that's because the cinematography...
It's almost like it's two different movies.
Well, you know, I read a review that said that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Look, I hadn't read that review. That was all me.
Yay,
me.
But see, that's the impression it gives.
Yeah.
It does give come across, this review was saying, I forget where it was, the old review, of course, that it trying to be a gore movie, the beginning, and the end, it goes more into like a psychological, like a thriller.
Yeah.
And it kind of flip-flop, kind of throws you because the way it flips. I didn't feel it was that drastic a flip.
No, but I could definitely tell where it happened.
Yeah, because it eases off on the gore and gets more into the psychological thriller. Mm-hmm. Where?
Yeah, well, essentially, once they take, oh, I forgot her name already. The
Pamela
young
Ferdin.
Girl. Yeah, the 15-year-old sister or whatever. Once they take her, it turns into a thriller for the most part.
Yeah. Not like Maniac, which we talked about a couple episodes ago, which for this type of film, for my money, is a much better film.
I agree.
And that nails it.
Yeah.
As far as the suspense, the thriller, the slasher, the gore, it keeps it all together tight. Pretty much the run of the film, from what I can recall. Yeah.
Well, and I'm sorry, I interrupted you earlier. You were going to tell us who the cinematographer was?
Oh, yeah. Well, the cinematographer for this is a guy named Gary Graver. And I was wondering when I saw the name in the credits, why is that so familiar? Well, because he was a cinematographer on the film we talked about in the last episode, Invasion of the B-Girls.
Ah.
Which was, listen to the podcast.
Yes, do.
Which was shot well. You know, it's a nice, tight little film, you know. But he was also cinematographer on a couple of Al Adamson films. The biker film Satan Sadist, which is kind of notorious. And one of my all-time favorite bad films. Then again, no, this is a bad film. I was going to say.
You have so many.
Dracula versus Frankenstein. Oh, my God. You would not know it's the same cat. Because that one is just really... The whole thing is awful, but it's really kind of pedestrian the way it's shot.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, apparently he learned a lot somewhere along the way.
Indeed. Because this one does have, it's got a nice little feel to it and a lot of, you know, the way the camera moves around.
Mm-hmm, it does. And there were a few shots that were really, really cool.
Yeah. And you're like.
Remember the one, there's one shot where the son is getting his mom a cold drink and he puts ice cubes, puts a glass on top of the refrigerator, puts ice cubes in it.
But it's almost right in front of the
camera. Yeah. You said like, it looked like close. It was shot for 3D.
Yeah.
Of course. That is a good impression that it was shot for 3D. It wasn't, but it was a really cool shot.
But there's a lot of other shots in it where it feels like it's setting up suspense with the camera.
Yeah.
You know, the way the guy opens a door and the door blocks the whole frame from what's behind, or the girl blocks the whole frame from what's behind her.
Right.
And you're thinking, okay, when she closes that door, there's going to be somebody standing there, and there's not.
Right.
But even before that, the way the camera is situated, when she's coming to the closet, you think she's going to open the door, there's going to be somebody in the closet. It makes you feel that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of misleading scenes that you build up the suspense. You're like, uh-oh.
Yeah, on that hand, it's not bad
right.
for most of the film. On the other hand, it just doesn't quite get going in the suspense or the thriller. It's like it's almost building that.
I will tell you that the most emotion I had for the entire film...
I know what you're going to say.
...was mostly that all the chicks in the beginning were just freaking idiots.
Yeah.
Every time the dude comes in to kill somebody...
Well, it's like they freeze.
Yeah, they freeze. And I get it. I know some people, when you're terrified, yeah, you freeze. I know some people do that. But every single one of them did.
And they're not selling that they're that shocked.
No. They're not screaming. Yeah. They're not. They're just kind of there.
Yeah, it's just trying to kind of move in a little bit, trying not to move too much, too far away.
Right,
you know?
Right. It's like, yeah, I got to stay in this right here. This is where I'm supposed to be. I can't move. And it's they were consciously trying to do this shot and scene.
No one had to sell that they're in shock.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It was very annoying.
And what about
the
one chick who was getting in the shower?
Oh my God.
This is great.
That was so confusing.
This is great. Now, to start off, this is definitely an exploitation film. Drive-in film, a grindhouse film. Because it's got the gore, it's got the, you know, and it's got copious amounts of nudity, which is you have to have in
these
types.
It's a staple.
And this girl's getting ready for a shower, and she goes into the bathroom, reaches in the curtain, cuts the water on, and then cuts the light on, I think, in the shower or something. Anyway, she sees a silhouette behind the curtain. She's, and she opens the curtain, and it's just a dress or something she had hanging in there.
Right.
Now, she had put on a shower cap before this.
Yes.
Hadn't got undressed yet, and she steps in the shower with her clothes on without turning the water off.
The water off.
Yeah, and then steps out.
Doesn't remove the dress that's in there getting soaked. Doesn't turn the water off before she gets in the shower with
her
clothes on.
Like she could have just reached her hand in.
Right.
You know.
So my whole thought process for why she got in the shower with her clothes on is because she was wearing a white top bra.
Just so we could see her in a white shirt.
I think that's really the only reason.
And then she gets out of the
shower.
Takes off the shower cap.
Yeah.
Goes over the closet. Takes her shirt off so we get, you know,
takes her pants off.
A nice topless shot. Takes her pants off. Puts on another shirt. And then goes in around the apartment doing stuff, or answers the door or something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
That was odd, yeah.
Oh, I know that's silly. It sounds petty to even pick on it, but it just made no sense.
Well, it did kind of take us out of it for a minute. We started discussing what the hell's going on here.
Yeah, well, I was confused. You
know? But before we get it further into the good and the bad of the film, let's talk about the cast real quick.
We're bouncing all around.
Yeah, well.
It's okay. We do this.
We haven't done that before here.
Never.
The director, Dennis Donnelly. This was his only film. He directed a lot of TV, though, throughout the 70s. Emergency, A-Team, Charlie's Angels, and single episodes of tons of other series.
Did you tell me that one of the guys in this was actually in Emergency?
Yeah, the detective who's investigating what's going on.
Oh, right.
A guy named Tim
right.
Donnelly, which is probably a relation.
Right.
He was the guy on one of the paramedics or one of the firefighters on Emergency. He was the one in the later seasons had the curly hair and the big bushy mustache.
Okay.
And kind of the comic relief guy, sort
gotcha.
Of.
Gotcha.
You know, but yeah, he's done some other stuff. You know, he had a lot of one-off things.
Yeah. Well, he looked familiar enough that I knew I'd seen him in something. I just wasn't sure what.
Yeah, but it was Emergency the big thing he did.
Gotcha.
And in addition to him, you had Anita Corsant, I think is how you pronounce her last name. That was Mrs. Helen Crump from the Andy Griffith Show.
Ah.
Played the mother of Pamela Ferdinand, who is the main chick in this, who doesn't get killed. Her name, you might not know her name, but if you grew
she'll know her face.
Especially if you grew up watching Saturday morning TV or any TV.
Yeah.
Throughout the late 60s, throughout the early 80s, she did a one-off of everything.
Yeah,
from
she was in something that
Star
I've seen,
Trek
I'm sure.
to Bonanza to Night Gallery to every TV show she did a little thing in. But she was also...
And what was her name again?
Pamela Ferdinand. Or Pamela Lynn Ferdinand.
Pamela Lynn Ferdinand.
Or Ferdinand. But what I remember her from as a kid, mostly, she was on the Saturday morning live action show Space Academy.
Ah.
And Sigmund and the Sea Monsters.
That's probably what I actually remember her from.
And she also was the voice of Lucy in A Boy Named Charlie Brown.
Huh.
And one or two of the other Charlie Brown movies.
So apparently she got some work. What happened to her? Where's she been?
You know, I think if she's the one I'm thinking of, she went off the rails with... I want to say it's like animal rights stuff, like PETA stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If she's the one, I think she shows up on Penn and Teller's Bullshit, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that's her. I don't want to pin it on her if it's not, but I think she did go off and do that. The other actors in this thing, Wesley Uhr from Land of the Lost.
Right. Wesley.
Yeah, who was billed as Wesley. And also, he did a movie, and I actually went to theater to see this when I was a kid, with Valerie Bertinelli, young Valerie Bertinelli, called Chomps. I believe
that
it was a Disney
familiar.
Film.
I don't think I've seen it.
Where he built a robot dog, mm-hmm. and it did all these things. It could jump high and had laser vision, all this kind of stuff.
I might have seen this.
Family film. Maybe. And Chomps stood for Canine Home Protection System or something like that. A robot dog. And also, of course, the lead who ends up being the bad guy, spoilers, Cameron Mitchell.
Right.
Cameron Mitchell's been in tons of shit over the years.
Yeah, you definitely recognize him.
I'll just rattle off a few things. I mean, he did Death of a Salesman, mm-hmm. the movie, How to Marry a Millionaire, Carousel, then Blood and Black Lace, the Bava film, The Swarm, which we talked about on a previous episode, and Without Warning, which is one I think I want to talk about sometime soon here. Another low-budget horror from the late 70s, early 80s, I think. And that's about it as far as the cast. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention Kelly Nichols.
Oh, right.
The poster girl.
Yeah.
Now, the poster for this was really fantastic. It's minimalist as far as there's not much on the background, you know. Of course, I'll put a picture of this up on the Facebook page. But it's kind of like the Texas Chainsaw poster, where it has, you
that
know,
wasn't
you have
on
the
purpose
killer,
at
have
all.
No. You have a killer and a victim and some words and not much in the background. But it's effective as hell.
It is.
Because
yeah,
the image is
it's a stark picture.
Effective.
It comes,
yeah,
it sticks with you.
The poster is much better than the movie. And Kelly Nichols is the girl that's in the poster, or on the poster, mm-hmm. rather. She's not a major, you know, not a major character in the film. She's one of the girls that gets killed, but it's the longest scene.
Right.
And it's the best death scene. One, because she's nude the whole time.
Indeed.
It's got the most going on in the scene.
Yeah.
You know, it starts off with she's taking a bath. She's in a bubble bath. And there's a whole scene of her masturbating in the bath, which is shot well. It's more suggestive than mm-hmm. literal, but you know exactly what's going on. And all of a sudden, she opens her eyes from that, and the killer is standing there in the doorway, which would be shocking to anyone, you mm-hmm. know?
I think he was humming the song, too, which was kind of creepy.
Yeah. Oh, and that's another thing about this. The whole time that this is going on, her death scene, there's this country folk song playing. It was real... you know, sweet, melodic, just soft song playing the whole time this horrific act is going on, mm-hmm. which is kind of cool because it was a counterbalance to what's happening.
Right.
You know, and I really like scenes like that when things are done like that because the music is supposed to make you feel one way, but the visuals make you feel a different way, and it makes it more eerily creepy, I think.
Yeah.
It gives you an unsettling, I guess, is more the word I'm looking for. But I like the shot, though, when she, you know, finishes and she opens her eyes and her reaction to seeing. And the way it's shot is the camera cuts to his feet in the doorway and you see blood on his boots from before, dried blood.
Right.
So, you know, it's not his first rodeo. And then the camera just pans right up to you see him there.
Yeah. Now, and I meant to ask you this earlier, the kills, they all kind of happen like in 2 days. Like he does multiple murders in one night. Right? Because he kills one girl, and then you see him open the door, and then he starts going to another door in
the
apartment.
The first two, or three...
It's all the same apartment building, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, because he's the owner of the apartment complex. You find out. Oh,
yeah.
I spoiled the whole movie. But I think the first three, because he gives to kill two people, and one girl happens upon him, and so he kills her in the apartment with one girl.
Right.
So three happen the same night, and then the next... It's either the next night... He kidnaps Pamela Ferdinand,
right.
Ferdinand, and kills somebody else, or kills somebody and then kidnaps
her.
Yeah,
he kills and then kidnaps, because once he kidnaps her, he doesn't go kill anybody anymore.
Yeah, and that's it. So there's only...
That's where the movie changes.
Yeah. There's only the four kills
mm-hmm.
over two nights. And, you know, it's funny. The build-up, the title, The Toolbox Murders...
Mm-hmm.
It's like the toolbox should be the star of the movie. You know, I mean, it should play more of a part in the film.
Right.
You know, and it's almost like an afterthought. He carries a toolbox and he uses some tools. But for that to be the name of the movie, I'm expecting a little more out of the prop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's almost like an afterthought to the killer, what he's using when.
Yeah. And there's really not a whole lot of gore, honestly. I mean, you see some blood splatter. But mostly the kills are not done on screen. Like you see him use the claw part of the hammer to bash the girl's brain in. But all you do
is,
yeah, you see him.
And
you see
her. Blood. That was done well, I thought.
Oh, it was done well. I just,
the shot's on him and he thrusts the hammer down into her skull. And when he pulls it up, and the camera's on him the whole time. When he pulls it up, you see a little blood dripping off the hammer.
From the claw, right.
That was real subtle and cool. And then when he does it again, he hits again, then some blood splatters up on him.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too much. It wasn't overdone. It was. Mm-hmm. I thought that was done really well.
Yeah. I can tell you, by that point, I decided that not that a serial murderer would not be crazy anyway, but I was sure that there was something really not right with this guy, because he was so erratic. He made mm-hmm. no sense. You know, he drugged the girl out of her apartment to the stairwell to brain her.
Yeah, and killed her on the landing.
Then picks her up and carries her back into her apartment. Yeah, so there's a blood trail. There
and then trails into the apartment. Yeah.
Right. So it just made
that
no
didn't
sense.
Make any sense to me. I don't know why. She's in the doorway. Why didn't he knock her out and push her into the door? Into
I have
the
no
apartment?
Idea.
I don't know. I guess they had to do that. They couldn't think of a better way because somebody had to find the girl.
Yeah, I guess so.
And
yeah.
I don't know why they did it like that.
I don't know.
I think they could have.
Well,
he could have hammered
her
and in the doorway and blood could have come out
yeah.
and then pushed her in the door. That would have made more sense than dragging her out.
Yeah.
You know, 10 feet away and then taking her back.
Taking her back. Well, and you know, at first I was a little confused to why he was doing it at all.
Yeah.
But of course we learned that the reason he did it is because yeah. they were bad girls.
Yeah.
They were fornicating or whatever was not pure little girls, you know.
Yeah, and even that, I don't know why he started killing them. Because his whole motivation, what the beginning, you get this great shot, and I don't know, I have the DVD, I think it was a Blue Underground released in 2003, and since then, 2010, there's been a Blu-ray released. But
so maybe it's clearer.
I hope so, because this one's a little dark. The scene in the beginning, it's one of those great 70s shots, though, where the camera's inside a car driving down the strip or something. So you get a lot of nighttime scenery,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're inside the car driving. The camera's the driver. It's a 70s film. You know it was made in the 70s from this shot. And then you get flashes. The car's pulling up slow to this sidewalk area, and then it cuts to another car, or it stops,
mm-hmm.
and you hear the sound of a car wreck.
Right.
And at first, before when it stopped, I thought something was wrong with the DVD. I'm like, oh, crap. But then you hear the sound of a car wreck, and then it cuts to another scene of a car had wrecked.
Hit a pole
and a girl,
or something.
Yeah, had fallen out of the car. And it cuts back to this car driving, and it cuts back to that scene. And that was a little confusing because the cuts started to happen a little faster, I think. It was weird.
Yeah.
But you find out later.
But once it gets into the other part of the movie where people are starting to die, you've totally forgotten about this scene at the beginning with the car wreck. Because nothing is said about it at all.
It doesn't relate to anything yet.
Right.
And then you find out later on mm-hmm. that was his daughter.
Right. And she died in the car accident.
And she died in a car accident.
Yes.
So that's why he kidnaps Pamela Lynn Ferdin, because she looked like his daughter. So he kidnaps her and has her tied up and starts talking to her like she's his daughter.
Right.
And that's where you get the psychological thing. Now,
yeah.
I can be of two minds with this. Cameron Mitchell's portrayal of a crazy guy, where he wasn't selling the crazy to me. He didn't have the crazy eyes. And there's a fine line where you can oversell that kind of thing.
Sure.
You can play it too crazy, and then it becomes a parody mm-hmm. or campy, and then you can underplay it. And some people can underplay it and do it well.
And it's, yeah.
It was almost like he was just kind of saying the lines to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a good actor. He's done a lot of stuff.
But he didn't strike me as crazy.
No, I wasn't feeling it. But
the script of what he was doing was crazy.
Yeah. But.
But he didn't show it.
Then again, I wasn't feeling the creepiness of it.
Yeah.
But then again, with him just not acting crazy at all,
mm-hmm.
just saying the stuff and maybe delivering the lines as though he believed him. The character he's playing is just saying it because it's just normal to him.
Yeah, but I didn't feel that.
You know, yeah, I like I'm saying, I wasn't feeling it, but somebody else seeing this, it might have worked
maybe,
for them.
Maybe.
You know.
Although, if you look at
and you have to watch it yourself, and if you haven't seen it, and make your own decision on that.
If you look at his earlier scene, the only time you really see him in a scene prior to seeing him with his, what he believes is now his daughter, was the one scene where he goes to the girls' rooms with the police, and he sits on the couch and says, I'm sorry, the sight of blood really bothers me.
Yeah.
But he kind of does the same exact thing there. You can tell that he's, up.
I was looking to see a little
something different.
Flip.
Yeah. And I didn't see it.
Like
he was just the same.
He's being normal. And then when he's away from everybody else.
But I didn't see that.
Because what's his name in Maniac? It'll come to me. He did that fantastic, I thought.
Right.
Had his own psychosis and crazy when he was alone. Mm-hmm. And then when he's with people, he could be perfectly normal and almost charming.
Well, I mean, there's something that could be creepy about the fact that he's the exact same person from talking to the cops to talking to her.
That's what I was saying. That's right.
You said that earlier. But he, I don't know. It just didn't.
It didn't work for me. It didn't work for you.
It didn't really work for me either. Well, somewhere along the way.
And Wesley, to me, he didn't overdo it.
We haven't even said who he is. That is the nephew of the guy that owns the building, of Cameron Mitchell.
And he has his own brand of crazy.
He does.
He knows what his uncle's been doing.
He doesn't write it first. I think he has
a clue. No, he does.
He knows from the very beginning?
Well, he says when the kid finds the tools and confronts him.
Well, yeah, but he doesn't find the tools in the very first time we see him.
No, but he says, I know the family has to take care of themselves. That's why he takes care of this kid. His brand of crazy, he's not overdoing it and he's not underdoing it. It just wasn't that great of a performance for me.
No, it wasn't. The only time...
It wasn't bad, but he wasn't going over the top, trying too hard to be crazy.
No.
You know, and some people can play crazy and some people can't. And to me, it just wasn't working that well.
Well, the only time that I felt anything from his performance, other than confusion over what the hell's going on, was after he has killed his uncle.
Yeah.
And he goes back to the bedroom where, I don't know why I can't remember her name, where she's tied up.
I think the character's name was Laurie.
Laurie, that's right. Yeah. Thank you. Where Laurie's tied up. And he starts to, he unties her, and then he starts to kind of get handsy with her. And of course, you've learned somewhere in the fight between him and his uncle that apparently he and his cousin.
Yeah.
Had been
Karen Mitchell's daughter who died.
Right. Yeah. Had been intimate and having some sort of affair.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to her dad, of course.
Yeah.
So then he decides to take up with Laurie as if she was really the dude's daughter as well.
But he never calls her that. He knows that she's not.
Right.
But he's just going to say, well, you're here. Basically, well, you're here and you look like her. So you're going to be my girlfriend now.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And he rapes her.
Right, he does.
Now, that was shot good, I thought. Because
that was well done.
You see him, he's on top of her, and he starts to, like he's trying to take her top off, and she's fighting, and she looks scared shitless.
Yeah, yeah, well, she was the only one.
Fantastic,
She was the only one that actually put up a good fight and seemed like she was trying to get
away. And before anything really starts to happen, before it starts to make you, I mean, you're starting to feel uncomfortable, before it makes you want to, like, look away uncomfortable, it cuts, it fades to black, and it cuts to they're done. It's over. And she's kind of laying there, turned away from him. He's just laying on his back with his shirt off.
Rubbing her arm.
Yeah, and like, oh, that was great. And saying, like, we're married now, basically, or something like that. And I love this next bit.
Yeah.
How the movie ends. And he says something like, we're going to keep on.
Basically,
this is what
it's a forever.
People do, and we're together now. And she just kind of, it shows her, she turns her head away from him, and in the foreground on the table comes into focus. Is that what comes into focus? Is a little cup, whatever, the pins and stuff and scissors in it.
Yeah.
And you see that she sees that. I don't know if it shows her reach for it.
Nope, it doesn't.
She sees it and then it cuts.
And the next scene you see
the
is
next
her
scene
walking.
Is her walking away like in
like
the early morning
big,
hours.
Big empty parking lot.
Empty parking lot. And she's got blood all over the front of her nightgown.
And she's got the scissors. She's hanging onto them by like one finger as she walks.
And the movie ends like that.
That was really
cool. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that was the best scene of the whole thing.
Yeah, now it's worth it. Sitting through the whole movie, it has great scenes here and there, I think. Well, good scenes here and there. But it's worth it for that ending scene, you know?
Well, I'm not sure that I would ever watch it again to get to the end. But the scene
like I said, it's not a great film. But you don't feel cheated or like you wasted your time after that scene.
Yeah. No,
oh, okay. Oh, that was great. That was cool.
Yeah, because that scene was really well done.
There are some scenes. Any of the scenes with her brother are dead slow.
Oh, no kidding.
I mean, Mrs. Crump has better scenes, you know?
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of things about the script that I just was annoyed with. You know, for instance, when the brother comes home after Laurie has been kidnapped.
Yeah.
When he sees that there's a spilled drink on the floor and all her homework is sitting on the table and she's just missing. And all he does is grab a drink and sit down.
It takes him too long to put two and two together.
Yeah. Well, he never puts two and two together. Because then a few minutes later, his mom walks in and she throws her purse down and says something about, what are you sitting here for if your sister's not here? Go find her. And he said, well, she must be wherever.
Well, she has a boyfriend. So they think maybe she just went out with a boyfriend.
Right. And then she says, well, go get me something cold to drink and find her. Tell her to come here. So he walks into the other room, and that's where you get that cool shot we talked about earlier with the glass. Mm-hmm. But he comes back after getting her a drink, and she's like passed out on the chair. She doesn't really care either.
Well,
I guess she's just exhausted.
Well,
but
she says, you find out later that she works long hours. She works at a bar, and she works a lot of hours.
Yeah.
All
but
the time. She gets home around 2, or I gets off at 2 most nights. So
yeah. It was just another one of those things that you don't get the feeling of there's any urgency in the fact that her 15-year-old daughter has gone missing at 2 in the morning.
You're not reminded that, hey, there were murders in this apartment complex last night.
Yeah, like 4 of them.
Yeah.
It was strange.
Oh, I meant to mention earlier, speaking of the poster girl, Kelly Nichols.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the longest scene in the film, a death scene. She was the stunt double and the body double, I guess, for Jessica Lange in the De Laurentiis King Kong, the 78 King Kong film. And after that, she did a few other things. She went into porn.
Right.
It's unusual. I think she says on the, she has a little interview on the DVD, which I'm sure is on the Blu-ray too, that she did it backwards. She was into straight films.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, she got her SAG
toolbox
card.
Murder. She got her SAG card. She did some stunt work, body double work, and then she went into porn instead of went into porn and got out of porn.
Yeah.
But she did porn for a few years in the 80s, and then she got out of porn and went into makeup. And I think to this day, she's doing makeup in regular films and does makeup for porn films.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. She had a good outlook on everything. You know? And
she was fun to listen to that minute that interview. I think said it was like 8 minutes, but it didn't feel like 8 minutes.
No,
it was a cool little interview.
Yeah, she said she had a blast working on Toolbox Murders and laughed about how they didn't tell her about the masturbation scene until she was in the tub. And she's in the tub taking a bubble bath, and the director's like, could you play with yourself a little bit? She's like, okay.
Wish she'd have told me this ahead of time, but all right. I think she said in that interview, too, that apparently her death, I don't know where she got this information, but she said her death was Stephen King's favorite death on film.
Oh, yeah. I read that somewhere else, too.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Which I wouldn't doubt it. I mean,
it was a really cool death.
Yeah. It was. She got hit with a nail gun. One of the first times that was used on film.
Nail gun's little.
Yeah. And it wasn't gory. I mean, the first one she gets in the gut and she like, you see him shoot it and she puts her hand there and you don't see much blood except behind her when she moves away from the wall. And she dies with her eyes open, and then he, nails her
through the head,
and you don't see much of that in the front, but
just
the blood goes up
the
wall behind
her,
which was kind of cool.
Anji, wasn't that a black and white picture of her?
Yeah.
Kind of showing that she was a model or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, so that was kind of cool. Tobe Hooper actually did a remake of this in 2004.
I've never seen that.
Which Tony and I watched it years ago, not long after it came out, I guess. We rented it or something. It wasn't that great. It didn't follow the plot of this one. It wasn't like a shot-for-shot remake. It was basically using the title and the loose premise of it. I don't remember a whole lot about it except being really underwhelmed. Sherry Moon was in it. Sherry Moon Zombie. And I don't think she was in the whole movie. I think she got killed off rather early.
Hmm.
But, you can check it out if you want. But I like Tobe Hooper. I love most of his films. That one I almost forgot that he did. I did forget. I forgot how he had anything to do with it.
Wow.
I mean, it's no Chainsaw. It's no Funhouse, you know.
Right.
It's no Eaten Alive, which is one we're going to talk about eventually on here. Definitely need to watch that again. But this one, like I said, it comes from that era of Maniac and Chainsaw, the mid to late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely got that grindhouse drive-in feel to it and appeal to it.
Yeah. Well, I think that I read somewhere that they put it out just because Chainsaw had gotten such a well-received.
I can't remember the guy's name. The producer of the film, I think, was aware of how well Chainsaw was doing.
Yeah.
And was looking for another
project.
And
they wanted to capitalize on
that. And got with some writers to write me a version of Chainsaw, something similar to that, that they could sell to the same markets.
Yeah.
And this is what they came up with. Like I said, it's not a bad film. It's not a great film. If I was going to watch another one again, and I keep comparing this back to Maniac because we talked about that recently. I've watched it recently. And it comes from about the same time, and it has almost the same kind of feel, or like it wants to feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely watch Maniac again, I think. And yeah. I wouldn't care for this one that much.
Yeah, I don't know that I would watch it again. I mean, it was worth watching. Like you said, the scene at the end was really cool.
Yeah.
Mostly, I was so annoyed with people dying in the beginning that I was so glad
their
that it
stopped.
Their
reactions to what was going on.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know if it's because they were terribly directed or if they just weren't good actors or what, but it was very annoying to me.
Well, I was just waiting for it to get going more.
Yeah.
You know, more of what it started with some good ideas.
Well, it was just like randomly
the quirky bits of the killer.
Yeah.
Where the first time you see him was great because we don't see his face the way it's shot. You see his body, and the girl lets him into her apartment. So you're like, okay, it's somebody she knows because she just let him in to do something. And then he kills her. After he kills her, he pulls a ski mask out of his bag or box or something and puts it on, and then camera pans up to his face. Now he's got a ski mask on sideways, and nobody told him.
That was so weird.
Both eyes looking
at through
one eye
hole.
It's amazing
how much that annoyed me.
Yeah. But he puts it on, and I don't know why he put it on then. I mean, he didn't need to put it on because she's already dead, and he didn't need to put it on because he needed her to let him in.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody saw him going into her apartment, then they saw his face because the ski mask wasn't on.
And for him to leave, if somebody, you know, walking out, they would remember somebody with a ski mask, but they might not remember, you know, random dude.
Yeah.
You
well, they mean? Probably would know who he is.
But I mean,
if
they saw
the
him walking all the ways away or something.
Yeah,
there's no reason for him to put on a ski mask at that point.
That was very. Well, there were so many weird things about this movie. And I don't know if some of it was like the characters were just written that way.
Yeah.
Or if it was just not written well, not thought out well. I don't know.
I think there was a novelization of this.
I'm almost curious enough to read it.
Well, what I found out was the screenwriter for the movie wrote the novelization, but it did vary a bit from the movie. It was a bit different, and it went more into the characters' backgrounds and stuff too.
No.
So the book might be a good thriller. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it would make more sense.
Yeah, probably.
Very strange.
Another cool thing about this, I talked about that opening scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just classic 70s, the way it's shot and the night scenes and all that. You get a lot of good shots of the apartments and the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Then, like I said, the way the camera moves around, you get to see a lot of this 70s decor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's unmistakably what era it's in. And it's great because it immerses you in the world that the movie takes place in, because you get all the surrounding elements of it. The bar, especially when she's going and open up the bar, and then the apartments and the outside of the apartment buildings, the architecture. I love stuff like that.
Well, we never actually said what this whole thing was about, but I think people have probably figured it out by now.
Oh, what, the plot?
Yeah.
Well, the basic plot is somebody's going around killing people in this apartment building. Come to find out, it's the landlord, the guy that owns the apartment building, is doing the killings. And he kidnaps one girl after the second night of killing somebody. And his nephew, who helps him clean up the apartments and stuff, works part-time, is apparently in on it. Hasn't done any of it, but knows about it. And is his own brand of crazy. And that's the basic
plot.
That's
really it.
I mean, there's not much else.
I mean, I think probably everybody picked up on that. We jumped right into stuff, and I don't know if anybody figured it out.
Yeah.
Really, it's just murder. Murder and mayhem.
And folk music.
Yeah.
I'll go back, say it again. I love the way that scene, the death scene, has the nice, pretty music, and then this should be a horrific, tense scene.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it still is, because you don't know which way to go, so it's uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, so at the end, after the really cool scene where Lori's walking through the parking lot, all bloody, scissors.
Oh, one of those great things that only happened in 70s movies, or early 80s too, maybe.
Yeah. Some text flashes up on the screen saying that the events of this film were based on actual story, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And I don't remember all of what it said, but basically it was saying the characters
happened 3 years earlier.
Or something
like that.
But from what we can tell, the events never actually took place.
I haven't researched that.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research on it, and from everything I can find, I have not found anything that resembled this.
It's a great scrawl. I wish I would have kept it up so I could read it word for word. But
well, there might be a picture you can put on Facebook.
Basically, it says the events portrayed in this film are based on actual true events that happened. And Lori, in quotation marks, after the events was...
Yeah, like three or four years.
spent in a mental institution for 3 years. But since she got out and got well, she's married and has a few children and is living
living 4 miles away from where they were killed.
You know, that's great.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. It just makes you wonder at first, oh, this really happened? I don't remember this story. But then from what I haven't done in-depth research, but pretty much everybody's saying no.
Another one from this era we have to do is Town of the Dreaded Sundown.
Okay.
It's another one that's based on true events. And from
what I understand, actually based on
true
events?
I think
it was. Okay. But, well, that's fine.
Yeah, we'll have to watch that one. And then there was the Town of the Dreaded Sundown, supposedly a remake, came out a few years ago.
Oh.
I don't think it's on Netflix anymore. I want to see it because it wasn't a remake.
No. Oh,
it was a copycat.
Oh, weird.
Copying the things from the film.
From the film, right.
That, I'm like, oh, okay, that sold me. I'm in, but I didn't get a chance to see it.
That's kind of cool.
So we'll have to check that out, definitely.
Yeah.
I can't think of much else to say about this one other than it's worth a watch. I mean, if you dig stuff out like I do, the way things are shot and the way the cinematographer puts the camera to set up the scenes and all, and the way the camera makes you feel, not as much as the acting does about a scene, then definitely...
Maybe more.
Maybe more, you know. Then definitely give this a watch. Toolbox Murders on Blue Underground DVD and recently released Blu-ray a few years ago. I think it's still available. I don't know if it's on Netflix or on Roku anywhere.
Yeah, I'm sure it's out there
Amazon,
somewhere.
Amazon. It's pretty easy to find. But give it a watch and make your own decision. Like I say every time, definitely watch these movies yourself. Draw your own conclusions and make your own decisions. And, you know, hey, drop us a line if you've seen it after that on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page or the Phantasmo After Dark email, which is phantasmoad@gmail.com, all one word, phantasmode@gmail.com. Tell us you agree. Tell us we're full of crap. Tell us whatever. It'd be nice to hear different opinions on...
Yeah. Maybe somebody else really loves this film. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, this could be somebody out there. This could be their favorite slasher film from this era. Who knows? It's been around a long time. It's one of those that I've always heard about, you know. So maybe, maybe not. We'll see. In addition to that, speaking of the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, of course, I'll put the trailer for this up and put a folder of, you know, many cool pictures as I can find from the film or behind the scenes. So always check that out, too. Now, we didn't mention at the beginning, but a few things coming up in the area here. If you're going to happen to be in the Tidewater Hampton Roads area of Virginia the next couple weeks, there's some pretty cool things coming up. Next Saturday, May 27th, is the Sci-Fi Yard Sale.
That's 2017, in case anybody's
confused.
That's right,
2017. The Sci-Fi Yard Sale. You can, I believe, is there a Facebook page up for that?
I'm not sure if there is, but it's...
It will be at 4844 Linshaw Lane in Virginia Beach from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. There'll be all kinds of sci-fi, horror, genre collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
Not just yard sale stuff. There'll be some really cool, decent collectible stuff like you'd find at a con.
Yeah, and it's a multi-person yard sale, so there's lots of tables.
It's almost like a mini con. And,
yeah, just outside.
It's like a vendor's room at a con at a yard sale instead. There's going to be multiple vendors there. There'll be some yard sale stuff, but also be some cool, you know, decent collectibles. We're going to be setting up with a table there, so it'll be a lot of my handmade stuff and odds and ends. So come check that out. I'm also coming up in the area. Let's see. The following Friday, which would be June 2nd, is Flick It Fridays at the Narrow Expanded Cinema. We're going to be showing Princess Bride. I'll be hosting that, and we'll be giving away prizes and trivia contest and all kinds of cool stuff going on, and you get to see Princess Bride in the theater. After that, Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, our free double feature cult movie night that we've been doing for, what, the last
14 years or so,
at the Chesapeake Central Library in Chesapeake, Virginia, it's Oliver Reed night, and we're going to be showing Night Creatures and Curse of the Werewolf up on the big screen, and that's all free, so come check that out. Then after that, June 11th is Pass the Popcorn, summer blockbuster-themed burlesque show at the Narrow. I'll be hosting with some amazing burlesque performers. come check that out. You can get tickets for that online or at the door. And then after that, we will be at Monster Bash.
Oh, that's not till the end of June.
Taking a weekend off at the end of June. So come check us out at Monster Bash and have some, be our first time going. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That's all the current events coming up in the area. I think we got one other thing to do, don't we?
Yes, indeed. How does this relate to Planet of the Apes?
Our ongoing segment that we started a few episodes ago. And just to set this up, Clayton and I discovered many, many, many years ago that the world revolves around Planet of the Apes. Long before the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever, we discovered that everything relates back to Planet of the Apes. Sometimes you can do it in a few steps. Sometimes it takes longer. But we're going to do it here again. Phyllis is going to pick something that relates to the topic of tonight's podcast, and I'm going to relate it back to Planet of the Apes. Here we go.
Well, I always like to relate it to the thing we're talking about, although that almost seems like an unfair advantage, like you could have tried to do this ahead of time, but you haven't. So let's do Cameron Mitchell. He's done so much.
Oh, God. Cameron Mitchell?
That should be easy.
Yeah.
But anybody I pick from this movie could go to Cameron Mitchell, so.
Cameron Mitchell to Without Warning, to Jack Palance, to Buck Rogers, because he did an episode of Buck Rogers, and so did Mark Leonard, who was Urko on the Planet of the Apes TV series.
And you're done.
Good night.
That was really fast.
There was a lot of people in Without Warning, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Martin Landau was in that. Neville Brand was in that. Tons of people. We'll have to talk about that one sometime.
Well,
but anyway,
good job, Rod.
Thank you. That was a quickie.
I guess that's about it, huh?
I think so. I think that'll about wrap up this episode. And until next time, thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.
Good night.